Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:03 p.m. That is on November 22nd, and of course being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought we'd kick off today thinking about the distortions that massive quantitative easing, extraordinary monetary policy, the turn to huge fiscal stimulus is having on the markets. Eventually, these debts are going to have to be paid. But the question, of course, is when and at what stage do the distorting effects have a self-fulfilling quality to them that eventually causes self-destruction? That's one of the things that I think we do have to be aware of. We've definitely seen that stock markets are doing better. But when we look at, for example, an index of private equity firms, I think there are two things that immediately pop out. The first is that they are prone to volatility. The sector pulled back extremely violently in 2015 and 16. It then rallied equally, even more impressively in 2016, then pulled back again in 2018, but it's been ranging now for most of the last year. We've seen the proliferation of alternative asset classes. I remember, you know, a decade ago when people talked about alternatives, it was primarily to do with structured products. Structured products certainly got their comeuppance in the credit crisis of 2008. What we have today is a completely different batch of alternatives. On the one hand, we have the art market, which has accelerated higher over the course of the last decade. There have been extraordinary, I guess the best way to think about it is that there have been extraordinary prices set for some of these pieces of art because the value of cash has been deteriorating when there is no interest rate paid upon it. When we then think about the fact that all of this additional cash has to find a home somewhere, eventually we can see that actually, in fact, both Sotheby's and Christie's have been taken private themselves. So we don't get to see just how the auction market is doing by looking at their individual stock charts. When, for example, we look at the luxury goods sector, that's heavily influenced by China. So that's also not a fantastic arbiter of the effect of this move into private equity. What we certainly know, and I'm posting two different articles in here today, is one is about the nature of the art market, where a lot of people who have got large art collections have been borrowing against them, using them as collateral. There has been an equally important trend among the services offered at some of the bigger banks to high net worth individuals, where they have been issued money against the collateral of their stock portfolios. And that has been to buy trophy assets like a private jet or a luxury yacht. Then we have the increasing pressure that's coming to bear on the collateralized loan obligation market. Well, all of that is pointing towards the real fact that there has been an incredible upsurge in the provision of our capital to these alternative assets. I posted this chart yesterday in Comment of the Day, where it highlights clearly that if you look at the totals that have been attributed to the private equity markets, or private markets, since 2006, we're approaching $5 trillion. And that really is a rather extraordinary set of circumstances. Then let's think about, where has that money come from? If $5 trillion doesn't just manifest itself out of the ether, it has to come from somewhere. Well, the incredible compression in yields over the course of that same period from 2006 onwards, well, that has set off a pursuit of yield that has been nothing short of panicky for pension funds, for governments themselves, and for the insurance sector. They are the ones who've had to try to diversify. How on earth is a pension fund going to meet its investment horizon or its investment assumptions of 8% per annum when bond yields yield 1.5%? If they're running a simple 60-40 or 50-50 or 40-60 portfolio, then the return expected from equities to make up for the return on the bonds at a yield of 1.5% is out of character with what is normal historically, and therefore they have to take on additional risk. Well, then you have the influence of modern monetary theory. Modern portfolio theory. Modern portfolio theory is pretty simple. It says that by holding a portfolio of diversified assets, you can protect the portfolio from drastic drawdowns, and the diversification in the portfolio will contribute to a positive return over the long term. That's highly attractive to the portfolio management sector, particularly when they're faced with this challenge of trying to pick up yield. So they went off and they bought a whole load of alternative assets. Well, the alternative assets are certainly private equity, for example. And by investing in early stage companies, well, you get the base effect. It's a lot easier for a company to go from its first $10 million in revenue to $20 million and double than it is to go from $1 billion to $2 billion or $100 billion to $200 billion in terms of their ability to generate profits. So by investing in early stage companies, then they were able to benefit from the base effect, because also then we've had and it persists this incredible period of time where there has been abundant capital that has made it much more advantageous to borrow a pile of money and bet on the ability to gain market share before competition sets in. We can certainly see ample examples of that when we look around the market. Uber was really the first of the ride-sharing companies. They spent an inordinate amount of time as a private company, and now the share is down about 50% off the IPO value. Now the bigger question I think investors should be asking is, which one of these companies is in fact going to survive? Because we are now seeing much more competition on a global basis for ride shares, whether that is Lyft or Grab in Southeast Asia, or Didi in China, and even Didi in China has got at least two or three copycats. There is not room for all of them. Some are going to go bust, and then the money that has been invested in those companies is going to go to money heaven. Well, then when we think about the space sector, Boeing, Rocketdyne, Raytheon have been the leaders in developing rocketry for decades. SpaceX has been able to completely disrupt the sector. Then you have Blue Origin, which is also a privately funded venture by Jeff Bezos, trying to get exactly the same space. Pardon the pun, but they're all trying to gain market share in what is a new business. Then you have Virgin Galactic. They're looking at space tourism. I think there is probably a better chance of some of these companies surviving simply because the space sector is a completely virgin frontier, and there is ample potential for additional growth in the sector that can support a number of these kinds of companies. But this also is a not a winner-take-all kind of environment. When we look at the kind of volatility that some of the the larger satellite companies have experienced over the course of the last couple of years. It has been incredibly profound. One of the reasons for the massive decline that we saw in Intelsat over the course of the last 2 weeks has been that the Federal Communications Commission said that they're not going to use the bandwidth that the satellite operators have access to, although they perhaps will get some kind of royalty as a result of some use of those bandwidths. The reason that it had gone up in the first place was because the massive debt load that some of these companies have, which is very clearly now a risk because they have got competition. Some of these satellite companies never really had competition, and they are in the same position now that taxi companies were in. Taxi companies had all of these assets they had paid for because they licenses for taxis had been extremely expensive in a number of large cities that created a moat for a significant number of taxi companies, which evaporated with the introduction of ride-sharing. The satellite companies also had a moat in terms of the development of the asset and then the cost of launching it. Well, now they are launching nano-satellites and launching 60 to 100 of them in one go, and the cost of launch is about $2 million. Well, that pretty much makes the satellites that are currently up there worthless, or worth significantly less than they used to be. And what that also suggests is that some of these companies are probably going to go bust. Well, Macy's in here this week had some rather negative news there. They've certainly pulled back a lot already. The price is steadying in here today, but they have had negative sales, and they had more negative sales in here this week. They've also had a cyber breach, so that's also a rather significant challenge. Then when we think about, well, where are the success stories? Well, I think it's pretty obvious. The clearest success stories are those that are leading on the technology front. There is clear potential that the semiconductor sector is in a new upswing. We can certainly think that there's probably room for some consolidation in the short term, and that does appear to now be underway. But we have the rollout of 5G coming in 2020. It's been the networks are pretty much built. There's still certainly networking equipment that needs to be put in place, and the rollout on a national front is going to take a little bit of extra time, maybe another year and a half. The first 5G phones are in the market. 5G, I've long been saying, is an enabling technology. Not only does it increase the speed of internet connection by about 1,000 times, but it cuts down in latency. This is going to create a massive business opportunity for a significant number of companies. Well, the one sector that has dealt where latency is a real problem is in computer gaming. Google announced in here this week the release of its Stadia, the subscription service for computer games. That is likely to be a sector that benefits substantially from the rollout of 5G. It probably isn't there quite yet, but there is the scope that it is going to be a significant factor. Microsoft is also a major force in PC gaming, and it's also likely to benefit from that. Well, Activision has been able to become one of the largest companies in the sector by being able to create massive online worlds, and the lag being removed from that kind of activity is something that could attract more investors, but more players. Then, if we look at Intuitive Surgical, I think this is an interesting company. It did fantastically well in 2017 and through to towards the end of 2018, and it's coming back up towards the upper side of its range. The origin of the company is in some DARPA investment that they wanted to create a robotic surgeon that could be used remotely so that they didn't have to put the lives of highly trained physicians in danger in war zones, but rather that they could have the surgery done remotely. Well, the machines exist, but the lag in terms of the internet connection was just unsupportable. It couldn't be done remotely, not with the kind of accuracy and the safety that would have been necessary to operate on live human beings. Well, the advent of 5G changes that. And we've already seen in China that there was a surgeon in Hainan performed surgery on a patient in Beijing. And that's within the last couple of weeks. That was not with an Intuitive surgical machine, but rather a copycat machine. Well, of course, that also highlights where some of the risks are out there on the horizon. The trade war and the theft of intellectual property is a significant factor, and it's not about to go away anytime soon. However, we are at a rather interesting period of time. The S&P 500 remains really quite steady. Now, I think there are certainly short-term risks of some consolidation, particularly in view of the fact that the market has rallied impressively to break up and out of this almost two-year range. The clear trend of additional support coming through from the Federal Reserve, whether that is because of the repo market or because of other factors, or whether they are whether or not they are engaged in a new quantitative easing program or not, the reality is that they have added $300 billion into the market within the last 2 months. And if we think about that, they started doing that at the beginning of September. And since the beginning of September, the market has rallied pretty impressively, and most particularly since the beginning of October. Well, one of the things that people were very keen to point out was the correlation between the S&P 500 and the size of the Fed's balance sheet, and that was particularly true all the way up to the peaks in early 2018. Well, they stopped increasing the size of the balance sheet, but then they started raising interest rates. That very choppy action we've had was also a period where the resolve of Jay Powell was tested. Let's not forget that Jay Powell came into office in January of 2018. The stock market has a history of testing new central bankers, and it promptly pulled back by 10%. I think everyone rationalized that by thinking, well, it really had gone up an awful lot in 2017, and there was room for consolidation, and the market subsequently found support in the region of the trend mean and continued on to new high ground. What was particularly interesting during that time was a 10% pullback was not enough to shake the resolve of the Federal Reserve, and they raised interest rates on three more occasions all the way through 2018. So the market tested them again and pulled back by 20%. Well, what did people want to know? What was the thing that people were most concerned about before the big pullback in December? In December, everyone was worried about a recession. But prior to that, the big rationale, the big narrative was whether there is in fact a Powell put. Well, we do have the answer. They have cut interest rates three times. In other words, they have completely removed all of the interest rate hikes they put in 2018, in 2019. Then they are now starting to increase the size of their balance sheet again. At the very minimum, they have stopped decreasing the size of the balance sheet. And that is all happening against a background where the USA is running deficits in the region of $1 trillion a year. And even in today's world, where the value of fiat currencies isn't a fraction of where it used to be, $1 trillion is still a lot of money. So I do think that's rather important, that when we start to think about a lot of the negative subjects that have been brought up, and there is a lot of discussion about whether there is a recession on the horizon or not, I think it is also just worth remembering that we went through a period in 2018 where there was a lot of uncertainty about monetary policy, and in 2019 a lot of that uncertainty has been resolved. So what we are now looking at is a period where the Federal Reserve has pretty much given up on the attempt to try and moderate the impact, the inflationary impact of massive fiscal stimulus. So at the moment in the USA, we have now got synchronized monetary and fiscal stimulus for the first time in at least a decade. And that is one of the primary reasons why the stock market is at a new high. When we look at the NASDAQ, well, it is loaded with some of the larger technology companies, so it has been doing somewhat better. But even the Dow Jones Industrial Average, which is more defensive in nature, although it does still have Apple, has broken up and out of its range. When we look at the S&P 500 equal weight, and I'm going to actually can't remember the ticker for that. So what is, I think, rather interesting is that it has also broken on the upside. So what that is certainly telling us is that the advance we're getting is pretty broad-based. What we're also starting to see now is that we've had some acceleration in some of the larger companies like Apple, and they are now susceptible to at least some pause and consolidation. What we're also starting to see is that some of the companies that have been underperforming for most of the last couple of years are testing their respective trend means. Some of the bigger technology companies in Asia are starting to break on the upside. Taiwan Semiconductor is equally susceptible to some pause and consolidation. When we look at, for example, the dollar price of Samsung Electronics, then it has broken up and out of its range. And now the question is it going to put in a first step above this little base formation? I think that the lead we're getting in technology is being led by the rollout of 5G. It's also being led by the rollout of 5-nanometer and 3-nanometer chips, which is certainly Taiwan Semiconductor's wheelhouse. Those are the kinds of innovations that are going to enable whole new additional sectors. The biotechnology sector is, I think, one of the most important globally. Now, it's also highly cyclical. This is the point in the cycle where we would anticipate that cyclical sectors should do better. But what's happening in the biotechnology sector is, I think, groundbreaking because of the business model. The traditional pharmaceutical sector is characterized by treatments rather than cures. The cures business is more about vaccinations. Vaccinations tend to be rather inexpensive because everybody gets them, and they are largely generic in terms of their production. When you think about the kinds of money that Novo Nordisk, for example, has made from treating diabetes, it is a wonderful set of cash flows, because when somebody develops the disease, then they need progressively more of whatever the drug is as the disease progresses. The only way that they have of mitigating it is radical lifestyle change, which means stop eating sugary stuff and get more exercise, which is rather difficult for people to do, or they take more and more of the drug over time. That contributes to a massive both the reliability of the cash flows and then growth in individual cash flows from each one of the patients, and diabetes is a growth market. So that has been a really phenomenal growth story for the market. What it has also done has been able to create an entire ecosystem of companies that are setting out to try and tackle diabetes from a symptomatic vector. Why is biotechnology so important? It's because they're developing cures, and they're doing so from a genetic perspective. What we're starting to see now with the evolution of CRISPR is that these companies that claim that they own the intellectual property are coming out with their own solutions, and that is starting to raise awareness that these companies are capable of producing cures. Well, the problem with producing a cure for a chronic disease is that it will kill off the cash flow, and that is going to represent a massive challenge for a number of pharmaceutical companies, one of the biggest societal challenges we have today. It's a massive question for the UK in its election. It is about national health. It's about providing the best possible care to the greatest number of people, but how on earth can we control the cost? It's also a massive source of tension in the USA, where some of the, well, it's upwards of 18% of GDP is spent on healthcare, and they have worse health outcomes on a total population basis than countries that spend far less. The creation of cures rather than treatments for chronic conditions is a real potential outcome within the next decade. One of the reasons why we don't have it yet is because of the amount of time it takes to permission drugs. But what we are seeing is that a number of companies can get through their genetic solutions for orphan ailments where there are no known cures or treatments. That way they can get permissioned much faster. Then they can get a revenue stream. All of that, that entire process, regardless of the fact that it takes years to even achieve those kinds of gains, is about proof of concept. The proof of concept will then get deployed to chronic conditions. And that is a massive challenge for the healthcare sector. But it is perhaps the biggest tax on consumption that we have in the world today. The cost of treating chronic conditions, the cost of treating cancer, runs into hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. The kind of innovation that we're getting in the healthcare sector today is of the same kind of game-changing proportions that unconventional oil and gas had for the conventional oil sector. What it means is there is the real potential that the cost of healthcare will start to trend lower within the decade, because it will tackle some of the most expensive chronic conditions. And I think that is one of the things that could potentially be deflationary. It's the kind of solution to the inefficiency of illness that could contribute to base formation persisting in the bond markets. One thing we certainly know, though, is that gold prices have broken on the upside. The reason I believe gold has broken on the upside, it's not because there is a shortage of gold. In fact, mine production is at an all-time high. So the massive quantity of money that was invested in new mines in the bull market all the way through to peak in 2011, in fact, the underperformance of the gold miners sector, regardless of the fact that it peaked in 2011, this was a massive period of underperformance relative to the gold price. That subsumption of the profit motivation for investment in new supply has ensured that mine supply is at a new all-time high. So, therefore, if supply is increasing, why is it that gold prices have popped on the upside? Well, I rather think that it is because people want to hedge. They know that we have these intractable challenges in front of us. I think that it is reasonable we're going to have a complete reshaping of the healthcare sector within the next decade, if perhaps a little longer, because it's a complete necessity. The simple fact that we simply cannot afford to pay for healthcare for hundreds of millions of retirees will eventually create a solution to this problem. That's, I think, one of the biggest potential game changers that we're likely to see in the global economy over the course of the next decade. But in between now and then, what we're likely to see is continued efforts by governments to try and placate populism through spending money. The rallying cry for populists everywhere is, what about poor me? And the answer of administrations is, here, have some money. And that's exactly what we're seeing in the UK today. It's what we've already seen in the USA. We're seeing it in an increasingly large number of countries. It has certainly popped up again in Australia. And the Canadian provinces are engaged in fiscal stimulus as well. Christine Lagarde, speaking today, was really rather clear, telling the European governments that they need to start spending. Quite whether they're going to agree to that, because it runs contrary to their political objectives, is another story entirely. But the reality is we are increasingly moving towards a situation where we have synchronized global fiscal and monetary stimulus. And of course, what that means is that they are devaluing fiat currencies. Well, that helps to support the price of assets that cannot be printed into existence. And it's likely to result in a somewhat longer period of strength for art prices, for example, or private equity or property. But the bigger point is that gold is still at a fraction of its peak value, whereas the prices for all those other assets are at all-time new highs. And therefore, on a value basis, gold is by far the cheaper hedge. I think that is one of the most important factors. Well, I did create some, what I at least think are important ratios in here today, but I thought I would start off first and look at the Dow gold ratio. So when we think about that, it has got an incredibly long history, and when we look at this over a long period of time, then what we're presented with has been this incredible sequence of events which has persisted for 100 years, where we have these cycles that can move in very long time frames, with approximately 35 years between each of the peaks, the first peak being in 1929, the next peak being in the mid-60s, and then the next peak in 1999. When we look at the ratio, it has found support in the region of the trend mean on at least two occasions now. It's done so again in the mid-1980s before it started to accelerate higher. I think that this remains an environment which is going to be supportive of equities. I do think, though, that when we look at the long-term horizon, there is the clear potential that equities are going to outperform for the lengthy medium term. If that is indeed the case, then the ratio is going to push back above the trend mean in the not-so-distant future. There is the potential that it could be ranging for a prolonged period of time, because gold has just broken up and so has the Dow. And if they're both running on the upside, then the ratio won't go much of anywhere. There is the potential that in this cycle, both equities and gold will do better, because they are both responding to similar stimuli. Where I do believe the risk resides is in the private assets, and also the high yield sector, where there is the potential that if we do get a further slowdown in growth, we will have more companies downgraded into high yield, which will then start to push up the yields and push the prices down. When we then think about where those risks are most likely to manifest, it's going to be within pension funds, and probably most particularly in pension funds that have been most desperate to capture yield. We're just not quite there yet. Then we think about, there have been a number of arguments I thought were rather interesting, that when we look at leading indicators and the slowdowns we've seen over the last few years, that this has, I think, contributed to this step sequence uptrend in the S&P 500. When we look at it over the decade, we've had three 18-month consolidations. And that has, I think, been each one of those has had a clear risk of recession and of rolling over and top formation in each one of them. We haven't seen yet that the yield curve has contributed to a surge above 50 basis points. In fact, over the course of just the last week, the yield curve has been contracting again. This is really quite similar to the kind of condition that we saw first in 2006, but much, I think, more relevant is the kind of activity that we saw in 1998, where we had a very mild inversion. We had a pop on the upside, and then it came right back down again, and it was when it pulled back even more. That was obviously a signal of stress, but when it starts surging higher, that is when we need to get really worried about the activity in the stock market. We also know that it can be a lead indicator of anything up to a year and a half. And considering the fact that it was first inverted in August, then the potential for trouble in the stock market is at least a year away, and potentially more than that. Well, if we're thinking about the the cyclicality of the market and the seasonality, then if we think about the U.S. presidential cycle, it's the second half of the third year generally tends to deliver a really positive performance, and the fourth year tends to be among the best performers. Considering that this has already been a very impressive year on the upside, when, for example, we look at the world equity indices, we can see that the S&P 500 is up 24%. The only market that is even close to that is the Chinese market on a currency-adjusted basis. But Europe as well is up in the region of about 20%. The Nasdaq is up 28%. Usually after a really impressive year on the upside, then that generally is not repeated the year after. I think, though, it is worth considering that we did have an awfully big drawdown in the fourth quarter of last year, and that a lot of the move we had in the first quarter was just unwinding that. I do think that we are likely to see that the breakouts hold on Wall Street, that we are ready for the next step higher in this secular bull market. There is the potential that we're now at the stage where the market could accelerate. Valuations are on the higher side, but they're not silly. We have certainly seen some silly valuations brought to the market from the private sector. And the success of some of the IPOs, or I guess the lack of success in some of those IPOs, has been a factor that really has shaken some of the confidence in the market. This move that we're seeing is broad-based. It's been led by the technology sector. It's been led by cyclicals. A break higher by cyclicals is something that we do anticipate in the latter stages of a bull market. And the continuous commodity index has been able to push back above its trend mean. Let me just zoom back in and look at just the last 10 years for that. It is right now around 403. It was in positive territory yesterday. It's in positive territory again in here today. If it can continue to hold that 400-point level, well, then we can say that the downtrend has been broken. I think oil prices are looking really very interesting at these levels. There has been a downward bias for most of the last 12 months. The price now is right in the region of the trend mean, and we've had a really impressive rebound over the course of the last 3 days. When we look at the futures curve, there is a wide backwardation. Going out to 2022, that backwardation is just about $7, or at least $6.50. And that is indicative of a short-term shortage in the market. The problem for the, one of the supporting arguments for thinking that we could see higher prices is that West Texas Intermediate is trading at about $58, and the break-even for a lot of shale drillers is somewhere between about $50 and $60. In other words, the price is not high enough for them to hedge production. Back in 2018, they got a pop to the upside in the middle of the year to up above $70 and close to $80, and that allowed a lot of producers to hedge their exposure at really profitable levels that was able to persist for most of this year. Well, the hedges have probably now run off. And what that suggests is that there is less money moving into into additional drilling. And we see that the drill count is going down. Well, what that suggests is we're going to see some of the higher priced producers turning into problems. And Chesapeake is one of those. It's collapsed over the month of November from 150 to 58 cents. This is a company that has got expensive leases in Oklahoma, but that's the problem, that they are unable to persist with prices even at these levels. Of course, the fact that natural gas prices are a lot closer to 2 than they are to 4 and have been for most of the year, that does represent a challenge, although I would say that it is quite clear now that natural gas appears to have found support around the $2.50 area and is trading back above the trend mean for the first time since January. This does look like it has potential for recovery. Oil prices could potentially sustain a move above the trend mean, and that would create the conditions where we might see some of additional hedging activity by the shale drillers, which would then create additional supply and turn the backwardation into a contango. That probably won't happen though until prices get up towards the $80 area. I think the most important point though is that when we look at this on a long-term basis, oil tends to have these incredibly lengthy periods where it ranges. Then those lengthy periods of ranging coincide with some of the biggest bull markets in equities. When oil and commodities generally start to do better, and there was a good decade of advances in the oil price, then that contributes to secular bear markets on Wall Street. We have now been in a ranging phase for the oil price for a decade, and the market has done nothing but rise over that period of time. In other words, as long as oil prices are ranging rather than trending, then we are likely to see a benign environment on the stock market. And the big question is, how long is that going to remain true for with the persistence of technological innovation in battery efficiency? What I found interesting last night, despite the fact that of Tesla's snafu with destroying one of the windows it said were indestructible during the reveal of its pickup truck, the bigger point is that the $40,000 pickup truck will have a range of 300 miles, and the most expensive one, around $65,000 or $70,000, will have a range of 500 miles. Well, that is multiples of where the range of vehicles was just a few years ago. And Tesla is certainly at the forefront of delivering these kinds of innovations. If people are spending less money on volatile commodity prices, then the impact of those volatile commodity prices on the economy is going to deteriorate. I think that's one of the most important factors. Where what we are likely to see, though, is that natural gas is going to continue to see an uptick in new sources of demand. When we think about the role of hydrogen fuel cells and whether those are going to be used as range extenders or as an alternative fuel to electric is still up for grabs, but it does look attractive. Whether it is going to be using natural gas as a reformant to create more fertilizers, to solve some of the food problems that are anticipated with a growing global economy. Personally, I'm not really worried about the availability of food. I think it is there is plenty of land available for food production that was basically idled because of the removal of subsidies in the USA and Europe. If we really wanted to produce more food, it is more than possible. It's simply not politically feasible, or at least politically supportable at the current time. I'm still really enthusiastic about the potential for technological innovation to deliver upon the kinds of innovations that are required to improve the human condition. There is the potential that with radical life extension, with the potential to treat some of the chronic conditions that make life difficult for a considerable number of people, with the real potential that we're going to see communications and evolution of whole new areas of technology evolving because of resting on the foundation of 5G, the creation of new sectors from space. These are the kinds of innovations that do have the potential to drive massive technological innovation and productivity growth. The productivity growth alone that could be delivered from autonomous vehicles whenever they're ready is something that I think can't be underestimated. Then, of course, there is the potential that fusion will, in fact, become a reality within the next decade. If we start stringing all of those things together, then the debt problems we have are inconsequential because of the potential for growth to take care of them. Where we do have a challenge is in the rise of populism, the rise of potential for generation wars. That is going to require a very significant national discussion and some cool heads. When we think about what the potential is, then I do think that there is a challenge in the creation of the or in the bond markets. What I thought was interesting in here today was if you look at I really can't remember the ticker that I created. I'm going to have to go back and find it. Certainly was looking at the change that we've seen in the relationship between the volatility on equities and the volatility on bonds. It was at an historic high last year. But what I found really interesting was this was the creation of this ratio. When we look at the as much history as we can possibly get our hands on, the equity markets outperformed bonds by a very considerable margin in the late 1990s. From 2000 until 2009, bonds outperformed equities by a very considerable margin. In fact, they unwound on a relative basis the entire advance of equities during the bull market of the 80s and 90s. Since 2009, the total return on equities has outstripped that of bonds by about 2.5 times. And if we see this breaking on the upside, well, I think it is logical to conclude that we are still in a secular bull market for equities, and that it is quite likely that equities will outperform bonds by a substantial margin over the course of this bull market. Of course, this is a ratio. There is the real potential that some of the money that is stored up in bonds could find its way into the equity market. That's been an argument that's been trotted out by people for at least the last decade. As long as bond yields, and obviously we've had a massive compression in bond yields over the course of this year, there's not going to be a lot of appetite for this argument. But if this ratio breaks on the upside, then it is clearly stating that the total return on the S&P is going to outstrip the total return on treasuries. And this is a very long-term chart. I think it's also worth thinking about the long-term moves that we're seeing in markets like Japan, where the market has been ranging or had been ranging below 20,000 for 20 years. And then it broke upwards and has been consolidating since. The European market has been going sideways for what feels like forever. But it is now trading back above the 400-point level, and it is holding it so far. We're seeing an increasingly large number of markets breaking on the upside. And these are markets that haven't done anything for years. Well, that is supportive of the view that we are going to see an additional leg higher. Doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to avoid a recession indefinitely, but what it does suggest is that even after an inverted yield curve, even if we are going into a recession within the next 12 to 18 months, it is quite normal to see the stock market do really very well in the 12 months ahead of a recession. And at the minimum, that's likely what we're going to see. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I wish all the best to all of you.